Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
From Connecticut Public Radio in the depths of the ocean, this is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf, and did you know the Mariana Trench is the deepest known part of our ocean? It's so deep that if you dropped Mount Everest in it, Everest would be underwater by over a mile. Before 2020, more people had walked on the moon than had visited the trench. Its deepest point, the Challenger Deep, is also the deepest known point on Earth's surface. On July 12, 2022, Dr. Don Wright, aka Deep Sea Don, became the 27th person and the first Black person ever to plunge its depths. Don is the chief scientist of the Environmental Systems Research Institute, or ESRI. She's also a professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. Today, Deep Sea Dawn will tell the story of her slow and record-setting descent. Find out how she felt when the vessel doors sealed shut, what she did on the way down, and, well, why we do all this. Dawn grew up on the Hawaiian Islands, surrounded by the most beautiful sea. And when she was around 8 years old, she wasn't finding herself peering down into that sea so much as she was gazing upward.
I was very much taken by the Apollo 11 moon landing, and the whole world was captivated by that, of course. But for me, it was something that further catalyzed my desire to study the ocean. I probably wanted to be an astronaut for maybe 5 minutes, because all over the U.S., there were children who were running around with goldfish bowls on their heads and little spacesuits and aspiring to be astronauts. And that hit me for maybe 5 minutes, but I wanted to become an aquanaut. And I was very much taken also by Jacques Cousteau's programs on TV, and just kept exploring how you go about becoming someone like that. Or I realized later that what I really wanted to do was science. Jacques Cousteau was an underwater photographer. The Apollo astronauts were scientists and engineers, and they were actually conducting experiments. And their exploration was for exploration's sake, but also had a scientific purpose to it, especially with the moon rocks that they brought back. So for me, I realized that I was really interested in the science aspect of things, and I wanted to study the ocean from that standpoint, and also to study the rocks under the ocean, to study the ocean floor, and to study volcanoes that come up from the ocean floor, because that's essentially what the Hawaiian Islands are. They're a chain of underwater volcanoes that made their way to the surface, and people live on top of those islands. But they're still very active. They are tremendous ecosystems above the ocean, but below the ocean, they are spectacular. And there are millions and millions and millions of places like that on our planet that have yet to be discovered and studied.
Yeah, I think that when people think about being an astronaut and going out into the space, I mean, that's the frontier. Like, that's the future. That's everything we should be pointing towards. But there remains on this planet plenty more room to discover and explore for the sake of our planet, yeah?
Oh, I think more so. More so. This is the point that those of us who study the ocean and explore in the ocean are trying to get across to people. Space is certainly the final frontier. It's endless. It's fascinating. We can look up and get instant gratification and see the stars and see the moon and sometimes see Venus and Mars, and people aspire to go to those planets. And we're sending probes to beyond our solar system, way out into the galaxy. Yes, yes, yes. But we have a planet that is even harder to survey than these other planets, because we are a water planet. 71% of our planet is covered by ocean, which is really hard to see through, which is hard to sense, but which is absolutely vital and critical for our everyday life, for the weather and the climate that we experience every single day. There is the notion now about how much the ocean is responsible for 50% of the primary production on Earth that sustains our food system and gives us oxygen. So over long, long timescales, the ocean has provided a large fraction of the oxygen that we take in every day. And then when you look at the bottom of the ocean floor, we've only really surveyed and mapped in detail 25% of that. And we are still so very far, so far behind in terms of our mapping. We have the totality of the planetary surfaces of Venus, Mars, and the Moon completely mapped, because sensors are only seeing through space. They don't have to see through water for those planets. So we actually have a much tougher, but a much more important, I would say, and gratifying task to complete here.
I know that you have a resume that could span many hours of conversation, and I'm sorry to not go through each and every single one of them, but I would love to hear about Challenger Deep. This happened in the summer of 2022. You had the opportunity to descend into the deepest known part of the ocean. Please tell me everything. What was the objective? What, just start wherever you need to start on that.
Well, we need a whole series of podcasts to cover everything, but luckily there are a lot of resources on the web that I would love to share with your listeners in terms of the maps of Challenger Deep and the background, how we came to know that Challenger Deep exists, because it was actually found almost by mistake in the 1870s by a British research expedition. Actually, the first global research study of the oceans aboard the HMS Challenger. And they threw the proverbial lead weight with tons and tons of rope that they had on board over the side. And they finally guessed that they touched bottom in this place that is nearly 7 miles deep. And remarkably, all of the modern mapping that we have done with our sonar systems to this day has continually confirmed that they found the deepest place on planet Earth back in the 1870s. Now, we have mapped it in more increasing detail over the decades, and Challenger Deep remains the moonshot for Earth explorers and certainly for oceanographers. And it was in the crosshairs of a very remarkable man named Victor Vescovo, who is he's a private equity investor, but he's also one of our planet's most astonishing explorers, because he's been to all of the highest peaks on the planet, including Everest. He has skied across, I think, both the North and the South Poles. You'll have to have him on your program to get all of the details. But he also had enough personal wealth to focus on exploring the oceans in unprecedented detail in terms of the deepest places. So he purchased a ship, a submersible, all the support equipment, the staff. And at the time, and I'm wearing the t-shirt of his organization, which is Caledan Oceanic. And he proceeded himself to go to the five deepest places in the ocean, including Challenger Deep. And so that was his quest from 2018 to 2019. And then having completed that quest, which is also, I think there are a couple of books about this, the most recent being The Deepest Map and The Underworld. The Deepest Map is by Laura Trethewey, and The Underworld by Susan Casey take you through those adventures. And there are other books as well.
Now, may I jump in and ask, and it seems like sort of a silly question, but why is it important to map these places, besides the fact that it's like the most, the deepest, right? What are we hoping to understand by mapping these places?
Well, these places are, most of them are in very active places on the planet. Challenger Deep is in the Mariana Trench, which is one of the biggest scars or fractures on the planet. And these are places where earthquakes occur. These are places that generate tsunamis. And so one major purpose for mapping the ocean floor is for public safety. It's a stretch to think about it in that way. But if we have more accurate and more detailed maps of these active places on the ocean floor, we can continually try to understand the processes that are creating earthquakes there. One of the holy grails of geoscience is to be able to predict earthquakes. So I live in California, and one of the huge efforts is to continually understand the San Andreas Fault and to understand when and where earthquakes are going to be generated at that great plate tectonic boundary, because there's so many people who live in California who need to be warned to evacuate from these areas. Now, we have a couple of amazing examples from the ocean floor. We have the Tonga eruption that took place recently, one of the biggest volcanic eruptions that we've ever seen on this planet, and the tsunamis. And I say tsunamis plurally because these large events generate many, many dangerous waves that eventually find land across entire ocean basins and are terribly destructive. There's the Japanese tsunami in 2011 that we are still hearing about in terms of the nuclear power plant that was affected there. It takes decades to recover from these massive events. So that's one major reason to map the bottom of the ocean, because that's where a lot of this activity originates. There are also other reasons, such as even the fact that we are having this Zoom call. The majority, all internet traffic is affected by the ocean by virtue of all the submarine cables that stretch across all of the world's oceans that are carrying internet signals and phone calls, streaming video, data. That traffic crisscrosses our ocean planet across what? Our ocean basins. And the companies that have laid these submarine cables and are continuing to lay them rely on very accurate, detailed mapping of the ocean floor.
So if not for like preventing earthquakes, at least, you know, so you can keep scrolling Reddit. We want to understand these things.
Or even getting our protein, the benthic or bottom fisheries, where we fish, rely on detailed maps of the ocean floor. And these maps are also, I would say, some of the most beautiful maps there are. If we could drain all the water off of the planet and look at that terrain that's down there, the most stunning vistas are there. Caverns, mountains, and of course, we know about the coral reefs. A lot of these coral reefs make up the bathymetry. What we're mapping is actually the extensive expanse of these corals. It's a completely different to us world down there. And how in the world can we protect and manage a place that we don't know about? But so, yes, exploration for exploration's sake is wonderful. But how can we not know about where we live and where we depend upon for our life and our livelihood? So just to put a bow on my little story here, after Victor visited the five deeps, he decided to take other people with him, particularly for Challenger Deep, to repeat visits to Challenger Deep. His submersible is a two-person submersible. So there was always a seat for someone else. And I got a call in 20, 21, inviting me to go with him to Challenger Deep, free of charge, by the way, because he has used the submersible to get needed funds to keep his operation going from rich people who can afford to pay $750,000 to go with him to Challenger Deep and some other places.
How did that phone call feel? And when you asked why me, what did he say?
It was actually an email, and I think it extended from a relationship that my company, Esri, had started with Victor in support of Kathy Sullivan's dive to Challenger Deep in 2020. So he got to know our company. He got to know a little bit more. He dug into my background a little bit more and found out about my experience with submersible diving in other places and my background as a marine geologist. And our company is a mapping company, and we had done a series of story maps telling the story of his organization and his ship and the limiting factor, and most importantly, Kathy Sullivan's historic dive with him to Challenger Deep, because she became the first woman to go to Challenger Deep. And then she also became the most vertical person in the universe, because Kathy Sullivan was the first American woman to walk in space. She has done all kinds of amazing things, including leading the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as their administrator. And she started off as a marine geologist, but she was in the class of astronauts that included Sally Ride and so many others, that amazing first diverse class of astronauts. And having walked in space and then taken a dive to Challenger Deep, no one has gone vertically a farther distance than she has.
That was Dr. Dawn Wright, aka Deep Sea Dawn. In 2022, she became the first ever Black person to visit Challenger Deep, the deepest part of our oceans. When we get back, launch, and then touchdown.
When you get to the bottom and the pilot turns on the lights and then you see the bottom, to me, that is like an Apollo 11 moment. You have arrived.
I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay with me.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygening it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. For oceanographer Dawn Wright, rock bottom isn't a worst-case scenario. It's an aspiration. As a scientist and ocean explorer, she's been as low as a human being can go, in an expertly engineered craft, of course. She's one of 27 people to have visited the Challenger Deep. This slot-shaped depression is at the bottom of the Western Pacific Ocean. It's more than 2,000 miles east of the Philippines and about 6.78 miles straight down. Back in 1960, Don Walsh and Jacques Picard became the first people to ever reach the Challenger Deep, and that was using 50s technology. It took 52 years for another human to visit that trench, and that was filmmaker and explorer James Cameron in 2012. Now, you've already heard Dr. Dawn Wright talk about Victor Vescovo.
He's by far Challenger Deep's most frequent flyer or diver. His first solo dive was in 2019, but he went back 14 more times and brought explorers from around the world with him. In 2022, Dr. Wright joined him and became the first Black person to experience and do science in this extraordinary place. Let's get back to our conversation. So, okay, will you bring me to the day of the dive? What was that? How were you feeling? Can you describe the submersible?
Boy, I'm trying to think of the right words. I was a little nervous. I've done submersible dives before, but this was different because of where we were going, because of the significance of the dive. We had a CBS news crew there aboard the ship with us, because part of the significance for me was to go as the first Black person of any gender to Challenger Deep. Victor has done a wonderful thing in my view, because he has chosen a diverse cadre of scientists to accompany him on his dives, particularly to Challenger Deep. So before me, he had taken Professor Y.T. Lin. At the time, Y.T. was with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He is Taiwanese. He is a fantastic ocean acoustics expert. But when he went with Victor, he became the first person of Asian descent to reach Challenger Deep. And then he also has taken several other women, including Nicole Yamase, who is the first Pacific Islander to go to Challenger Deep. And Dr. Yamase is a marine biologist. And that dive for her was a huge symbol for her people, for Micronesia. So for me, it was similar, because I've seen the reaction to my dive since completing it. We had a scientific experiment to conduct, and that was successful. But it's also the who did that experiment was really important. The operation, in terms of how the submersible is maintained, it's a two-person craft. All of the latest electronics, camera systems, everything to withstand going to this deepest place on Earth and coming back safely. It was completely certified. So there's a huge juxtaposition to the Ocean Gate Titan situation. That could be another podcast in and of itself. But this was a safe craft, and it was highly maintained. The staff were outstanding. A very happy ship overall. The dive itself was beautifully conducted. My life was in Victor's hands. We had no technical difficulties whatsoever.
Now, may I ask, when they shut the door, it's just, you're buckled in? Are you buckled in? Is there a seatbelt? Do you need a seatbelt? I mean, it seems like you probably wouldn't need a seatbelt.
No, there's no seatbelt, but you are in a very, very snugly, you're sitting in what's like a game chair. And so you're snugly in there, and it's a very tight space. It is like a little capsule, and there's only room for you to sit upright in that chair. There's no room to stand up. So when you are sealed in, yeah, you're sealed in. For me, that was not particularly unusual or exciting, because I've been in the Alvin submersible and the Pisces 5. So the experience was very similar. And in fact, the more snugly you're in there, the safer you feel. And there is a little bit of water that gets into the capsule. But
just to remind you.
Yeah. The amazing thing about you're basically sitting inside of a sphere, and the sphere is the geometry that is the most resistant to hydrostatic pressure. That's what's going to keep you safe. And if your sphere is made out of titanium, that's the material that is the safest. But you pierce that perfect sphere. You compromise that by putting in holes so that you can see outside of it, the viewports, and also the hatch. So all of that is resealed the deeper you go. Everything is compressed by this tremendous hydrostatic pressure, 16,000 pounds per square inch. At the very bottom, one colleague said that's like having 26 jumbo jets coming down on top of you. But that pressure is also your friend because it completely seals what tiny, tiny, tiny micro nanoscopic space there might be at the viewports and the hatch. So for me, the deeper we went, the safer I felt. That's the irony of it. But I know some people in the limiting factor were a little disconcerted when seeing water inside of the, a little bit inside of the sphere. And also you're breathing, there's condensation on the inside of the capsule because of our breathing. And we just have to clean that up with a towel, but you're perfectly safe. You're in no danger whatsoever of imploding, which is what happened to the Titan. They did not have that sphericity in what the people were sitting in, and carbon fiber is not going to resist. And they were only at around 4,000 meters. We went to 10,919 and came back safely. The trick is to come back.
Yeah. Now, just for some perspective, if you placed Mount Everest at the bottom of Challenger Deep, it would still lie more than 1.2 miles underwater, is how deep you're going, right?
Uh-huh.
First of all, how long did it take to get to the bottom? And what was it like when you finally got there? How did you feel?
Oh, well, it's a long way. So, and the craft, the limiting factor is designed to descend a little faster than other submersibles because it was built to set records and to get to that record-setting depth as quickly as possible. So it zips along at about 3 or 4 nautical miles per hour. I think the Alvin descends at around 2 nautical miles per hour. But even at that nice little clip of a speed, it took us 4 hours to get to Challenger Deep. And it's a beautiful, peaceful, calm elevator ride to the bottom.
Wait a minute. What did you talk about? Did you have work to do on the way to the bottom, or was it just enjoy the view?
Oh, all of the above. Victor spent quite a bit of time reviewing for me again the safety features of the submersible and what to do. I had been briefed on all of that by one of the staff, and who is my roommate, Kate Wawatai, who now is a pilot of this craft herself. But what to do in case he's incapacitated, the additional oxygen, we had to wear NASA flight suits in case there's a fire. Those are fire retardant suits. He explained to me all of the how the navigation is done, the cameras, everything. There was plenty of time to go through that. And then we also had plenty of time to enjoy going from the lit portion of the ocean to the twilight zone, which is the murky part of the ocean where things start to get completely pitch black dark, but where there's also probably the greatest biomass or biodiversity in the ocean is in this dark place at around 1,000 meters. And we spent a little time just communicating with the jellyfish and the siphonophores or worms that are bioluminescent. He would flash the lights of the sub at them and they would flash back. Absolutely.
Come on.
Amazing.
That's so cool.
A little fireworks show. And then we had plenty of time to get to know each other and to share our backgrounds and what we liked, and just to have a wonderful chance to get to know, for me, to get to know this remarkable and wonderful man who has now become one of my great friends. When we got to the bottom, that is always on any submersible dive, that never gets old because you're descending in complete darkness. You're looking out the viewport and it is like outer space because it's a void. There's nothing to see, and to think that all of these animals exist in darkness. In fact, we wonder why some of them have eyes, because these species, I'm not a biologist, I'm a geologist, but I've always had to learn about the creatures in these places, because that's a very important part of the whole system there. But when you get to the bottom and the pilot turns on the lights and then you see the bottom, to me, that is like an Apollo 11 moment. You have arrived and you see this alien world. that you have studied using other types of data, or you've seen pictures, but there is nothing, absolutely nothing like being there, nothing like seeing it. And the perception that we as humans have, our depth perception, the emotion that we have that goes along with seeing a camera, a robot can see something. And of course, once that is relayed back to someone who's sitting on a ship, there is emotion there for certainly, but it's a little different when you are actually there. Now, for us, we also had shock and dismay because one of the first things we saw was a green beer bottle.
It's obviously something.
What is that?
I don't know. We're going to find out real soon.
Wow, it looks like a lightsaber.
It's a bottle. It's a freaking bottle.
Isn't that something?
It's a bottle.
As soon as we get here.
Look, it's a freaking bottle.
Wow.
We were absolutely stunned to see in this place where no other human beings had touched down on this exact latitude, longitude, and depth, this X, Y, and Z. Here was within our sights. We didn't land right on top of it, but we saw it off in the distance, and we didn't know what it was at first. And of course, Victor went over to it, and there it was, a beer bottle that someone had thrown over the side. I don't know when, because it hadn't been there for very long. The label was intact, and there it was. Evidence of how literally no part of our planet is untouched by human activity or human nefarious activity. Do not litter, folks. It's against the maritime law, certainly, to throw trash overboard.
That must have been such an interesting feeling, because here you are in this remarkable place, one of so few people who've done such a thing, the first Black person to ever do it. This otherworldly place that is of our world, and there's a freaking beer bottle.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, it was crazy. But we are finding also scientific trash. You know, it's not just the beer bottle. This is a very important engineering research holy grail that's going on in the ocean science community. Can we leave no trace when we study the ocean? Because we leave cables, we leave weights. There are all kinds of things that are left behind. In fact, there's a place in the Western Pool of Challenger Deep that Victor refuses to go to because it has been visited by the other submersible who can go to those places, who can go full ocean depth, as we say. And there's a lot of cabling that has been left behind, which is a huge hazard, tangling hazard. That's one of the worst things that you can run into in a submersible, because if you get tangled, there's no other vehicle there to help you. You're on your own. You are completely autonomous. This was also one of the things that was very dangerous about the Titan, what they were trying to do in getting so close to the wreck of the Titanic. There's so many hazards there where you can get hung up, and that seals your death warrant. So in the ocean science community, there's a lot of work going on now about systems that can go down to these deepest places and come completely back up, leaving no trace, leaving nothing behind.
That was Dr. Dawn Wright, aka Deep Sea Dawn. After the break.
I just love thinking of the ocean as a sacred place. It really is. Challenger Deep for me now is a sacred, holy place.
I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay tuned. This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. We're back with Dr. Dawn Wright. She's the chief scientist of the Environmental Systems Research Institute, or ESRI. She's also a professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. In 2022, she became the 27th person ever in the world and the first Black person to reach Challenger Deep, the lowest known point of the Earth's surface.
She spent 10 hours down there with explorer and investor Victor Vescovo in his deep submergence vehicle named Limiting Factor. Together, they surveyed over 1,500 meters of previously unexplored parts of the southern wall in the Challenger Deep's western pool. Let's get back to our conversation. When you did this, you became the 27th person ever to experience the deepest point on Earth. You were the fifth woman, the first Black person to make this descent. What do you think about stats like these? And what did it feel like to be the first Black person ever to do this?
Well, I think these stats are still hugely important. I'm disappointed that we have to keep such stats. When I was a little girl growing up in Hawaii and watching all of the civil rights unrest on TV, my family is from Baltimore, and we would watch protests going on along the East Coast, including Baltimore and Washington, and of course, throughout the South. And I thought, well, you know, when I get to be an adult, this is all going to be solved. And we will be moving on to other things. And it's not going to make any difference whether I'm a woman or I'm Black or I'm Indian or I'm transgender. All of these things are not going to matter. And so I'm continually disappointed, I'll say, that progress is so slow. But it is almost a beautiful burden that we must bear. In fact, I love what Martin Luther King's daughter has said about this, that this is a long process. It's a life burden to bring diversity and new perspectives. We are seeing this over and over again. We don't have to go into all of the every single day, including what's happening in the Middle East right now. It's the same. It's like a vicious cycle. So on one hand, I'm disappointed. On the other hand, I'm incredibly energized and happy to have such a calling. Because for me, there was some social media backlash about why does it matter that she's Black? I even had some people saying, well, she doesn't know. She had no right to do this. She's you're not a scientist. You don't have the background to do that. This was just a stunt. You're nobody. I mean, I actually had that. I didn't expect it to. I've heard about this, but it was the first time I had experienced it. And for me, I think, and I'm looking over at my calendar because I have a Mary Engelbreit calendar. And this month's saying is, it's not who you are that holds you back. It's who you think you're not. And for so many people in the Black community, this is such a rarity. It's like how Black people don't do things like this. In fact, when I was on CBS News, Gayle King's reaction was, good on you, sister, but, you know, Black women, we don't get our hair wet. You know, this is not something that we do or that we aspire to. but it is. There's so many of us. In fact, there's a fantastic organization that's called Blacks in Marine Science. There are so many of us now who are doing this kind of work and telling young people that, yes, you can aspire to this too. You don't necessarily have to do exactly what I did in terms of studying the ocean, but you can go into space. Of course, you can be a doctor. You can be a social worker. You can be a mathematician. You can be all kinds of things. And these opportunities are not off limits because you are Black. Absolutely not. Your path may not be as straight as you would like. There are going to be difficulties. There are going to be challenges and barriers. There's going to be racism, but that absolutely does not need to stop you. So I think that's the message that I've been taking to. In fact, I'm just back from Towson University, where they have this fantastic Women in STEM program. It's called the Hill Lopes Scholar Program. I was so buoyed and inspired just being surrounded by so many beautiful young Black women, which I don't get to experience that enough where I am in Southern California, and also young women of all backgrounds. They are in this special program and they are soaring. They are majoring in geology and mathematics and physics and chemistry and engineering. And it was just fantastic to be with them and to encourage them. And also, I've been giving talks to elementary schools and middle schools. So I've done that type of thing all of my career, but now it's got a special urgency and an extended purpose because of the dive.
I love thinking about the idea of standing on the shoulders of giants and then becoming the giants for whom others stand on in the future. And I understand that your mom was a really, really big influence on you in so many ways. I also understand that she died in December of 2021, just half a year before you made history. I'd love to hear your thoughts on her influence on you and what you think she would have felt if she were around to see this grand accomplishment.
Oh, my mom was just the most wonderful, amazing person. And I hope all of us have someone in our lives like that. For me, she was my best friend. I don't have brothers and sisters. So when I was 5 years old, she gave me this little birthday card, Batman and Robin, and it had in it, "You and me against the world." And we have been sort of a unit, a duo, pretty much all of my life, especially because my father was not really a part of the picture. And she was someone who was in the humanities. She was a liberal arts person and was a specialist in speech communication throughout her career in higher education. A fantastic sense of humor. She was my heart and my mentor, my everything. And at first I told Victor about the dive that I would have to see, because she was at that stage in her life where I was her primary caregiver. And I didn't know whether I could be away to do the dive because of having to care for her. And we had our system set up. I experimented with having a nurse come in to help me with that. And the idea was for the nurse to become my replacement in terms of her caregiver while I was away. And that would allow me to do the dive. And we were making really, really good progress there. And I was able to tell Victor that, yes, I can do the dive because we have this system set up now and my mom will be cared for. Terribly, though, she didn't last long enough. She passed during that period that we were trying to prepare her for having the care that she needed while I was away. But she would have been so, so happy about the dive. Most of all, though, she would have been relieved. In fact, if you look at the CBS News segment about our dive, it's a wonderful joke at the end because they ask about my mother's reaction. And more than anything, she just would have been relieved that I came back safely, you know, as mothers do.
Was she on your mind when you were down there?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. She's on my mind on an hourly basis. And it's wonderful to have a loss that still inspires you and strengthens you. Even though it's just inconceivable that the person is not in your life anymore. It also helps me that I have my dog, because she adored my dog, and my dog was part of the caregiving process as well. She always wanted to have my dog be in the room with her as much as possible. And my dog, as dogs do and other pets do, completely sensed that and participated in that. Would put her paws on my mom's chest to calm her and would stay by the bed. So my dog is only 6 years old, so I have many more years with her. But we have this understanding that, okay, so it's now that the two of us, we have each other. And that really helps, along with all of the other continuing adventures that I have in this amazing job that I have at Esri, because the dive was a special project. I no longer go to sea on a regular basis. I used to, but my job at Esri is more administrative and working on research and development projects in different areas, including ecosystem mapping in forests. And so I'm doing a lot of different things. And that too is wonderful.
If you could time travel which I wouldn't put past you at this point. if you could time travel and stand on the beach with your 7-year-old self looking out at the ocean and tell her not only about this big dive to the bottom, but about all the other stuff you've done, what do you think she would say?
Oh, she would say, "That's awesome. I can't wait to grow up to do it."
Let's go.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it. And I'll stay with the plan. Because I was always a little girl with a plan. I even used to write out a schedule in terms of what toys I would play with. From 7 o'clock to 7:30, play with Gumby and Pokey. From 7:30 to 8 o'clock, watch cartoons. From 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, play with your Legos. And I would schedule out the entire day like that.
Do you still do that?
Now it's forced upon me. Where the demands of life do that. So, but I still do have a schedule that keeps me very, I'm perhaps hyper-organized, but it surely takes care of a lot of stress.
Well, what's funny is behind you, I can see all sorts of toys. So I'm glad to see you're still playing.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. The Lego building is still a huge thing for me. And I love doing it. I'm starting to run out of spaces in my home to put the models, but
Well, I've asked everything I planned on, and of course there's 10,000 questions that I don't have time to ask you. Is there anything I missed in terms of focusing on this dive and our conversation? Any holes in my questions, anything you hope we would talk about but we didn't? Also, with respect to your time, anything else? Open floor.
Well, I guess one other thing is that in terms of women, one of the things that I truly loved about the dive and being with the people on the ship were all of the people from there. I think there were 43 of us from 14 different nations. And I just have to say also how much I appreciated my roommate, Kate Wawatai. She is from New Zealand and she is Maori. And she was the only woman on the submersible support crew. She was in charge of communications during my dive. So when we would send our messages back to the surface and Victor had to check in with the surface ship every 15 minutes and we would hear her voice or hear her husband's voice coming to us. It took 7 seconds for a message to get to the ship and seven more seconds for their response to come to us. But she inspired me in so many ways, and I really loved getting to know her and to know now that she is going to be or is a pilot of this submersible. Another first Maori woman to pilot this submersible, and I hope that she fulfills her dream of going not necessarily to Challenger Deep, which she might do, but to the Kermadec Trench, which is the deep ocean trench that is off the coast of New Zealand. And that is a sacred place for the Maori, for her people. So I hope that she fulfills that dream. And I just love thinking of the ocean as a sacred place. It really is. Challenger Deep for me now is a sacred, holy place, similar to the beaches that I frequented and to some places in American Samoa. That I have been in a submersible to, and also to the East Pacific Rise. Our planet is a beautiful, fantastic, amazing place that we must do everything we can to not destroy, because we will end up destroying ourselves.
Well, Dr. Dawn Wright, thank you so much for all you've done, and thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, this is wonderful, Kion. Thank you so much.
Audacious is always lovingly produced by Letitia Peters, Jessica Severin DiMartinez, Khalil Rahman, Meg Fitzgerald, Meg Dalton, and Katie Talarski at Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. I know you love this episode, so you gotta go back and listen to the one we did with two underwater record holders. Dr. Joe DeTurri lived in a small subaquatic hotel for 100 days, and Budimir Shabbat held his breath for 24 minutes and 37.36 seconds. And please do not try this at home. And you could check out other water-centric episodes, like the one featuring a woman who is allergic to water. And you can hear a very special episode featuring extraordinary stories from people who've sent and received messages in bottles. We'll have a link to him at ctpublic.org/audacious, and you can find him wherever you get your podcasts. Stay in touch with me on the socials at Kyone Wolf, and you can always send an email to audacious@ctpublic.org. Thanks for listening.